All right, now let's get on with the show. But I ask your indulgence. 10 years, I'm going to pull a little bit of editor's rank and tell you one more story about why we are fortunate today to have Wiley Stateman, Mark Mangini, and Gary Rydstrom talk to you about sound as story. In 1991, I was 28 years old, a young editor at Mix, and I got a call at my desk. I had only written one story on John Cougar Mellencamp at that point, because the bosses knew I was from Indiana. And they said, "You know John Mellencamp?" And I said, "Well, it's a big state, but I'll try." I'm sitting at my desk copying. A story had come in about the Doors movie. It was written by an outside writer. I'd copied it, sent it through the process. 2 days later, I'm sitting at my desk. I get a phone call. Paul Rothschild, producer of the Doors. I don't know how he found my name, but he started screaming at me. And said, "This is a 2-hour and 10-minute movie with 2 hours and 4 minutes of music, Doors music, from the original 4 tracks. And you talk to the guy who recorded dialogue." If I had known better, I would have said, "Yeah, but he's an Academy Award-winning dialogue mixer." And I said, "What do you suggest we do, Mr. Rothschild?" He said, "I suggest you come down to L.A. and I'll give you the story." I went to my boss. I said, "David, I think he's right." 3 nights later, I was in Laurel Canyon. I ordered some pizza and beer, and I went to Paul Rothschild's house. I walked into his living room. I didn't know a thing. I'd read a book called Audio and Media in those 3 days. I had talked to one person who went to San Francisco State in 16mm film production. And I put a tape recorder in the middle. I walk into his living room, and I see Mike Minkler, Paul Rothschild, Bruce Botnick, the original Doors engineer, and Wiley Stateman. I set up a tape recorder and I said, "Let's talk about the movie, guys." Well, about 10 minutes into that conversation, I realized Wiley's my guy. they're all brilliant, but Wiley had this way of sort of explaining things. He had this enthusiasm, this intelligence, this "I love to work in movies" attitude. And it made sense to me. What he said made sense. I mean, I learned things like you use a waveframe for audio, for clapping, a waveframe audio frame for hand claps, and you use a Fairlight for editing dialogue. Sorry, Rich, there was no Pro Tools at the time, I don't think. There was Sound Tools, 1991. And I was amazed. I come back and write the story. I'm having a ball. And 2 months later, I'm sitting at my desk, and I get a call from Gloria Borders at Skywalker Sound. And she says, "Tom, we saw your story, and we have this little movie up here at the ranch called Terminator 2. Would you like to come up and talk to this? We have this guy, Gary Rydstrom." I go, I didn't know who Gary was. I knew he had been Ben Burtt's assistant. I found out he had done an audio ID with Luxo Jr., the lamp and the audio ID. There was no internet. I couldn't do my research. I walked into his sound design suite at Skywalker and said, "Hi, Gary." He looked a little like a professor almost. Calm, clean cut, wonderful, very welcoming, very genuine. And I learned that the sound of a Terminator walking on skulls starts with pistachios being squeezed between china plates. That with the root sound when a T-1000 walks through bars, that the root sound is dog food upside down out of a can. And I thought, that's kind of cool. And then he would walk over, and this was, still blows my mind, he would walk over to this keyboard called a Synclavier, which you might know of, and Gary probably still has one, I'm not sure, at 96 kilohertz sampling rate. Gary would play an effect like a chord, and he's like, "Here's how you create it," and it blew my mind. I had a master's in journalism. I didn't know what this was. Walk out, write the story. 2 months later, all in 1991, I get a call from Disney. "Hi, Tom, we saw that story on Terminator 2. We have this little film called Beauty and the Beast." And I go, "Sure." In 1991, a journalist could just drive up, show him an ID, and I walked around the lot. I couldn't believe it. I saw little squirrels crawling up people's legs, and I thought it was animatronic. And then from Mark, and I meet Mark Mangini. I think Terry Porter was mixing. Is that correct? And I meet Mark, and I learned, I said, "Robbie Benson, the guy from Ice Castles? That's the Beast? How in the world do you do that?" And I learned so much from Mark. I come back and write the story. That launched a 32-year career. it films sound. 10 years at this event. It wasn't until years later I realized how lucky I was. A young man tried to start out in a career, trying to figure out his own enthusiasm, but I come across what could be considered a Mount Rushmore of film sound in my first education there. It's a good lesson for somebody. You never know who your influences are going to be in life. I had no idea I'd be writing about film sound. It's become a big part of my life. And I've met so many brilliant and talented people across this industry. But these three were my first and helped form my opinion. It more than just their obvious talent and their cool way of working with sound design. It was, from Wiley, I think I learned this sort of full body approach to sound. Wiley has an entrepreneur's mind. I mean, he co-founder of Sound Deluxe, one of the strongest independents in the history of film sound. I find out Wiley essentially started the Hollywood Edge Sound Library because he wanted to find a way to pay for his original recordings. And it was a pretty smart idea. his obvious talent, but it's one thing Wiley always says that strikes me when I think of him with a smile on his face. He says, "What if we tried this? What if we tried this?" It's such a wonderful expression, whether it relates to digital technology or a particular sound effect. I've always kept that with me. From Gary, I learned just pure imagination. I mean, we all think of things, but how many of us can actually put them into practice? In creating new worlds, whether we're reimagining D-Day or we're trying to figure out how a T-Rex sounds, my imagination goes when I read a book. I can't imagine what Gary hears in his head when he creates a new world. It's just incredible talent. From Mark Mangini, I learned just like the pure joy and whimsy and magic and rock and roll guitar playing that he brings to film sound on his left hand. And on his right hand, there's a deeply philosophical approach to this world and a sense of trying to understand what a sound is and what it does to your brain. I didn't know any of that until halfway through my career. And I've learned from so many people, many of you out in the audience. But that's why these three are up here. I pulled editor's rank on the 10th anniversary, and I said, I want these three. It took 30 seconds in each phone call for each of them to agree to come here. So with that in mind, I would ask you to please welcome Wiley, Gary, and Mark. Come on up, gentlemen. Today's theme comes out of those original conversations. When I approached these three gentlemen, I said, I want to do something big for the 10th anniversary, and I'd like to talk about sound as story. It might sound esoteric, it might sound, what do we talk about? But they immediately jumped. I think, I can't remember which one of you said, thank you, Tom, I'd rather talk about the why than the how. And that really struck me in terms of developing a theme today. So you'll hear a lot today about sound for story. It started on those original conversations back in May with these three guys and the calls we had. So to begin with, gentlemen, every project, every film, every limited series is somebody's story. Somebody has that vision. Somebody spends years of their life wanting to work on it. When you get a script, when you get a sense of somebody's story, maybe you've worked with the director before, so you've talked on the phone, but Mark, let's start with you. I mean, where do you begin? Do you think I need gunshots? Do you think I need to be musical? I mean, what are the things that cross your mind when you first read a script?
I think you started it by alluding to this conversation we had about how versus why, which should really be why versus how. Everything I do is in a hierarchical structure of story at the top and maybe at the very bottom, what are we going to do about Foley? Which is to say, I didn't mean to throw shade on Foley. I'm trying to get to a, thank you, Gary. I'm trying to get to a much. Damn.
Off to a great start.
Why don't you finish that sentence? My process has to start with Foley. I can't get to how to do something until I know why I'm doing it. And that includes in a very horizontal plane. Sound design, sound effects, dialogue, and Foley. I can't make a T-Rex voice. I can't make an ornithopter. I can't envision the world of Arrakis until I know why I'm doing it. Once I've defined what that means, until I know the story, the how is not clear to me. And in fact, inversely, the how becomes patently clear to me once I understand the story we're trying to tell.
And Wiley, you even took it a step further back when you ask, why are they making this movie? I mean, it's a legitimate question. It sounds funny, but they're giving up part of their life.
I've spent most of my career working for writer-directors. And so that's a very unique sort of opportunity to really explore the why. But also, I think, you know, what's important is, you know, I start with falling in love with the project. And why would I love this project? And what about this project in terms of sound can we deliver on sort of the novel idea of why they would even want to make this movie? So, you know, for me, it doesn't start with belittling the Foley. I love Foley.
It's duly noted. Wait,
can we start over?
No. Absolutely. It starts with falling in love with the story. And then looking at the music, and then thinking about sound design and the various elements of what we need to accomplish from the production sound all the way through delivering the international versions and the M&E.
And Gary, then, I mean, one of the things, whenever anybody starts new as a writer for me, so they gather their information, I tell them, like, pull away now. You have your information. Think about what you want to say before you start writing your lead paragraph. I mean, where does it begin for you? I mean, do you mark up a script? Do you read a script?
I'll admit, when we first read the script, you're writing down a list of, I need to record this, need to record that. But
and do Foley.
And Foley. Well, obviously, and Foley. Yeah. You can get back at me any way you'd like. I feel terrible now. And then so Foley first. And then I make notes about left foot, right foot, cloth. And then that's the Foley first, and then work from there, work up. but what they're saying is actually that, and Wiley's, it's really true, you have to fall in love with the story. And I've had this thing where I love every movie I work on while I'm working on it, and if it comes out and it turns out to be bad, I'm completely shocked. Like, oh, it was bad. Oh. Because you have to love it. So when you first read the script, you really have to ingest the story. You have to understand the story. And the why is a good thing that Wiley said, because I would put it in terms of idea. Every movie, I think, has an idea behind it. Private Ryan, when we did, I think there is an idea that war is random. You know, so you can find kind of an idea, then you can kind of build around that. But also, what I think sound does best anyway, we can tell story points, we can clarify things, we can draw your attention, we can draw you along the length of the movie. But I think what it does most effectively is feeling. So when you're learning the story, you take in the story in terms of what happens, but you really got to take in the feeling. So, and obviously someone wrote this and wants to make it because they want you to feel something. So that's kind of the key.
That feeling imbalance, because the people you work with want your opinion. They want you to have some sense of the way you look at the story, and yet it is a director's vision or something. So how do you balance sort of your sense of what's right and working with what they may think of the story? I mean, Wiley, do you want to start? I mean,
yeah, sure. I always sort of place the emphasis on in terms of sound. And yeah. I talked about this the last time I was with this wonderful group. But everything that the filmmaker wants from us is usually defined by what we provide for them, which is somebody to sort of anchor and interpret the sound process for them. And so I think falling in love is essential, but what's essential is to convert that love into something that's tangible in terms of sound.
But bringing that opinion to them, do you do sound previews? I mean, how do you? Is it a discussion? Is it a word discussion? Is it playing them back a track? How do you convey what your opinion is?
Yeah, so the wonderful thing about sound is that it's invisible. So we get to sort of work in the theater of everyone's imagination. And so rather than to be a storyteller, I see it more as we're an interpreter. So we take the written word and we try and interpret that into what it might sound like. And I'm sitting here with two incredibly gifted sound designers who have done wonderful jobs in interpreting those kinds of visions. But I think that that's the biggest part of our job, is to provide this sort of invisible element to the filmmaking process, and to do it in a way that's very gracious and very flattering to the novel idea of why did they even want to make this movie.
Mark, if I could ask specifically that, because you had an interesting experience on Mad Max, where you came in a bit, and we won't go into that, but how do you come in? What do you bring at that point? When you come in maybe partway through a movie, what did you look at? I would say, when you talk about any film, but Mad Max, Fury Road in particular, your vision.
Well, I brought my opinion, and I would say that my success in what I do stems from my ability to communicate my ideas and collaborate with the filmmakers. I am hired because I have an opinion. And on Mad Max, the director did not feel a centralized sense of vision for what that movie should sound like. And I brought that. Now, what is difficult, it's easy to say, I brought my vision. The harder part, it arguably for our community, this collective community, is conveying your opinion and doing it with conviction. I think, maybe I only speak for myself, we as behind the scenes artists perhaps are less articulate or less able to stand in a room of people and say, here's what I think, and raise your hand up. I think that's really hard to do. And that was part of my job, was to be the person that said, George, here's what I want to do, and not have that kind of stage fright of presenting the ideas. I mean, we all have fear of approval. All artists do. And yet that's part of our job, is to say, here's my painting. There are no more brush strokes going on it. From there comes the collaboration part, because we do this as a dance with our directors.
And Gary, I mean, it's funny, I can remember one time in my career at Mix, somebody looked at me and said, well, how do I know what I think? And I thought, well,
that was me.
I'm going to have to get back to you on that one. But Gary, how do you develop that sense of confidence, that sense of what you can bring? Where does that come from?
I think what Mark said is really important, because we're part of the storytelling and the collaboration. And sound, since we come late in the process, we tend to think, you know, just pretty much get the movie near done, and then we do our part. But it's nice to be involved, even if you're just talking to people early on, the director. I love to go to the production design, you know, see what they're doing, and you know, certainly the composer, we can talk about that, but getting involved in music, and
we'll get to that in a bit again.
Yeah, getting involved, because part of the storytelling, it's much better to help tell storytelling if you're collaborating. So you do have to raise your hand and have opinions. And because I think when I started, you think, well, I'm young, I'm still young, but who's going to listen to me? But the truth is, when we talk about when you know something works, what you think, we've all grown up being audiences, right? So even before we became professionals, we watched things. We know what works for us. We know what's worked in the past. We know how we feel about it. So we already have that built-in talent.
I think what have you said? I look at it as an audience member, as a fan of movies.
I try to look at it, and it's really hard. And to me, the good directors that I've worked with are really good at forgetting all the detail they know about everything that went into the movie and turning that off and watching like an audience. And we all have to do it too. And it's not easy, because you think, God, that took a lot to record. I mean, imagine what it took to record that sound. I'm not taking that sucker out. So,
Wiley, do you want to say something?
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, I look around this room and I see a lot of people that are also eager and enthusiastic about the world of sound. And, you know, our world of sound really begins with getting respect, I think, in the filmmaking process. And what I'd like to say is that, you know, like the DP on the set, the sound designer, whether it's the production mixer, whether it's the re-recording mixer, whether it's the supervising sound editor, but that person chairing that department should be as valuable to that production process as the director of photography. So I've talked with my team, and we've said that there's really this role of the sound DP, which is really the designer and producer. And I just have to say that if you aren't feeling entrepreneurial, get in touch with that feeling. Because if you don't know how the money is being dispersed in terms of making the soundtrack, then you can't really be a good manager and or a good visionary in this process. So I think what we need is respect. What we have is the ability to create this art that's essential for film. I mean, you know, film without, you know, sound without picture is radio. Picture without sound is surveillance. So what we do really has a major, major impact on the filmmaking process.
And I do. And I mean, and we'll get to collaboration. I have found in my career, I was shocked that when I came down in 91, music didn't talk to effects. Effects is hearing music at the mix often. And it didn't always happen, but it happened enough that I thought, well, that's odd. Why would you wait till the end? I mean, when you talk about collaboration, any of you start. I mean, it has to do with the production sound mixer. What's the dialogue? What are your challenges? Somebody early in my career said, just pick up the phone and call them for 10 minutes and figure it out. Somebody start. I mean, that collaboration, let's just go right to that before we build our palette.
Probably the question I get most often in seminars and lectures is, how do you work with composers? Okay. And maybe we can just focus on that for a moment, because it seems particularly odd to me, especially at film schools, that isn't part of the sonic discipline that's taught. We share a soundtrack, dialogue, music, and sound effects, and they have to work symbiotically, and yet there is a paucity of communication between sound and music. It just seems odd to me. And so I like to be proactive in screenwriting, in pre-production, and in production with the filmmakers to encourage an ongoing dialogue with whomever is going to be the composer and what that might look like and feel like. And often, if I don't ask that question, it won't get asked, and that collaboration will not happen. And the last thing that you want is to end up at a final mix. And I'm sure many of you have arrived at a final mix where there has been no coordination and it's a free-for-all.
One of the things about, they all grew up with an independent spirit, these guys. In 1991, independence sort of ruled this town. And we had Skywalker, we had Weddington, we had Sound Deluxe. Were you able to sort of break out and get that idea going early in your career, talking to composers early? Gary, what do you do? I mean, do you get to talk to John Williams?
Yeah, well, it's a really important thing. It's actually one of the things that can be done much better going forward. I think technology and the way we work is changing enough that I think that collaboration between composer and sound crew is really important and happening more and more. I mean, when I started, I mean, I tried to worm my way into spotting sessions with the composer. I remember sitting in some Pixar movies with Randy Newman. And one of the things I would say, when we talk about music, one of the most important choices is where it is, where it starts, where it stops, right? That's actually really important. And I remember sitting in a spotting session for a Pixar film with Randy Newman. I suggested, let's take the music out here and bring it in here. And he went, oh, so we can hear the crinkle of the newspaper. Well, and yeah, so, you know, but it's...
Oh, no, the Foley. The Foley.
Hear the Foley. Well, he thought that way. So, but getting involved, like, as simple as that, I mean, in the classic way, the John Williams thing, there's nothing to listen to. These days, a lot of composers mock things up. You can listen to it early on, even if it's going to be recorded on a stage later.
But do you have to ask for it?
I mean, but I do. These days you should. Everyone should ask for it. And you should work against it. And you should send them stuff. You know, to go back, I mean, the best example I had in my career, which is it was Punch Drunk Love, which was composed by John Bryan. And we were both on the set. And he was composing stuff even on the set. And then I was sending him sound effects, and he was sending us music. We were putting themes from his music into the sound effects as kind of a quirky thing to do. It was a complete, and he loved it. So that there, there's room for improvement in this, and it makes a massive difference when you talk.
I want to add to that on Blade Runner 2049. We had a very consistent dialogue and collaboration with Ben Walfish and Hans Zimmer, because in the earliest of spotting sessions with Denis, which happened during filming, we developed this idea that we wanted the soundtrack in its most holistic sense. A soundtrack doesn't mean an album or just the music. The soundtrack is the sound of a movie. We wanted it to feel seamless and without borders, we would say. That meant that we wanted sound, sound design, score to flow seamlessly within and without itself so that the audience never felt a difference between the two. And that meant, as Gary said, doing things like sharing textures that we were developing in sound design, and they sharing samples and cues with us as they were writing the compositions, and attempting to erase the borders so that the audience never had to ask itself, especially a cineast audience, or comment during the viewing of the movie, that was a good cue, that was a good sound effect. If you erase those borders, that simply became, we think, that's just the sound of the Blade Runner universe. And that's the success you can have if you implement it and have the support of a filmmaker.
Yeah. I think the greatest gift we can give to the filmmakers that we work with, and I consider the film editor to be, or the editor, to be the most significant person that benefits from this process, is to prototype the sound early and to prototype it as a complete concept. So that's why music to me is so essential. You take music, you take production dialogue, you create a benchmark for the sound of the production dialogue, the acoustical space for the production dialogue. You wrap the music around it, you add the sound effects, the sound design, the Foley, and all of a sudden the approval process begins early, and we're not expecting the decisions to all be made in the last couple of days of a very chaotic mix.
And I will say that one of the things I most admire about these guys who had talked to them over the years is they're all musically minded. I mean, Mark plays guitar. Wiley thinks like a heavy metal guitar player or something. I'm not sure. And Gary might be on violin with, I'm not sure. But they think of the effects musically. I mean, we have those, there's rhythms on the city street that are music that we will hear in our voice. But now we're going to bring it back to story. I happen to have a fondness for backgrounds. And as a reader of, an avid reader of books, I love the sense of place. I mean, I think my favorite authors always give me this sense of New Orleans or Iceland, or where you can almost smell the beignets off the page. So in building your palette, in building your sounds, you have to give a story some place to sit. Can you talk to me about acoustic space or place as it evolves in a story?
Well, ambiences are important for that reason, setting place. I tell people, if you're making a low budget movie, or especially a student film, one of the best things you can, if you want to make a movie that takes place in France, you can make that the case with sound. So the ambience has the benefit of including a lot of sounds you can't see. So if you can't see it, it's the Alan Splett thing. You listen to Alan Splett's work, you don't even call them ambiences, you call them music, but he's using what you can't see, what's off screen, to make you feel something. And at every level, ambiences can make you know that you're in Paris or make you feel something. So it's this, it's almost a blank slate creatively about, yeah, you build that world that you can see, and it affects the world that, you know, it's telling a story from the outside angle.
Wiley? Yeah, it provides context, and it can provide conceptual space. And so I just love the idea that we embed a project with this context. It took place in this moment in history or in this geographical place. And we also impart context, and that is, what is the echo of the room sound like? What is just the EQ of the voices, and how do they all match? I mean, production mixers have a hell of a job trying to balance booms and lavs and the various ways that they record their production sound or the production dialogue. And it's really the job before finishing the project to put this into a contextual space where everybody sounds like they're working together in a scene.
I think there's also perhaps a technical bent to this preparation of atmospheres, because I think the subconscious is constantly scanning the soundtrack for tells that this feels real. And when you can place the audience in a believable 360 degree or immersive sonic environment, and that usually means the ambiences, that frees the brain to focus on story more rather than the subconscious distraction of, I don't feel like I'm really there. Therefore, I think it's a valuable exercise for all sound designers to make their ambiences as immersive as possible, which is to say, if you went out and recorded in New Orleans and so that you could smell the beignets, you might want to go to a place where that's really happening and capture it multi-channel, not in mono, not in stereo, perhaps multi-mic, ambisonic. There's so many ways to capture properly. And sometimes all you need is one bed of something that is 100% believable. It creates that verisimilitude that makes you feel like I'm really there.
Well, it's interesting to me. In 2012, I believe, I went to the Dolby Presentation Theater for the launch of Dolby Atmos. And they had the technical press there. And Randy Tom comes out and shows the opening reel of The Incredibles. And there's children zooming overhead. There's people flying by. And they played the clip. And he got up there and he said, now you're going to have a lot of people running jets over your head or sending bullets across there. But the beauty of Atmos is the rain falling in the forest with leaves. And that's the real beauty and the talent. I mean, can you comment on that, Gary?
Well, yeah, actually, early on, I made a trailer for Dolby Atmos, because I had the idea, like, Atmos is not about whiz-bang panning. You can do that. It's great. You can pan. Actually, but a sense of kind of slow change and atmosphere. So I did a trailer for Atmos, which is a little leaf that falls from a tree and swirls, and then you follow it down to the water. And the whole premise of it was to go slow, and was a single shot. I mean, Atmos is great if you were to do a POV movie where you're moving through space like that. Yeah. Then you can use it's amazing. If you're doing quick cut action movies in Atmos, it's harder to make it read as much. So I forced my way into the Dolby world and said, I want to make a trailer showing that you can do it slower, single shot, about things not just whizzing by your head.
I'm sure they welcomed you. You forced me.
Then they made the whizzing by your head trailer after that.
Well, I thought that was the EX chip, Gary.
Oh, EX. We want to talk about EX for the next 20 minutes.
The other thing I want to talk about is there's a couple of words, if we could. Gary, you once said to me, big scenes, a big battle or something is challenging. Don't get me wrong, but it can also be challenging a kid on a piece, a pane of glass, and it's a glass is starting to crack. That can be the most challenging scene to do. Both of them imply focus, and I would like if you could each comment on this term, because if you're in the Fast and the Furious and there's 42 cars down the street, how do you focus? Who wants to start there with the word focus? Wiley?
Yeah, okay. So I think you focus on one thing at a time. And I've worked this with my team and with other sound designers. It's really like a parade, okay? You just have to have one instrument at a time going by your conscious mind. And the most ideal thing is to keep it as absolutely simple as possible. You know, our brain processes sound in a very narrow, ability. Our ability to focus visually is probably 10 times what we can focus on sound. And so keeping it simple, making it like a parade, having the most important thing up front and that's the focus.
I think Walter Rich once said in an interview, clarity above density. I mean, Gary, not to single you out, but the opening scene of Private Ryan, at the bake-off, you said, you're going to hear a lot of bullets. That was The best dry humor in the industry, too, by the way. But my point being, there's in terms of picture and everything, that's a terrifying scene. These are kids and you're looking at them, they're terrified. There's a lot of bullets coming, but you remember, there might be one that scares the shit out of you. How do you get, I mean, how do you make one, like that sort of one whiz by among that, among D-Day?
Well, people would call me up and say, we love the D-Day scene. We want to do a scene just like that, a battle scene, and we're going to end with music. Well, that's not going to have the same effect. It's hard. I mean, what you learn, even in a battle scene, you learn that more is not more. More is less. And you have to always, you know, sort of layer things so that you're bringing things up to the foreground. Like Wiley says, taking it back down. It's always shifting. I think of like a relay race or something where it's always shifting. You can have layered sounds and complex sounds. They're better usually for an audience if they are complex over time as opposed to complex all at once. If they're complex all at once, you don't know. I mean, Private Ryan is a little bit meant to be a little more chaotic than other action scenes I've done. So actually the chaos is one of the things that's scary. But that occasional thing that comes in and, you know, sort of gets you is important. But focus, and Spielberg, he said it many times, and he figured this out long before I worked with him, is that the ear helps the eye see something. So I can't tell you how many times I worked on a film with him, and I haven't seen something important in the moment. And he says, what about that? And we put a sound in for that. And then when you watch it, damn, your eye goes to that thing. So for focus, it's one of the goals we have for sound, is to help focus the audience's attention where you want it to be.
Mark, Mad Max Fury Road there's a lot going on, but it never feels like a bombardment. I mean, there's screaming metal music. I mean, can you talk about focus in terms of the track?
Sure. Interestingly, George Miller would say to us on Mad Max Fury Road, Mad Max is a movie we see with our ears. It's very similar to what Steven said. Though I knew instinctually this idea of sonic focus, and that's the best way to get through a mix, George would frame it very neatly for me by drawing a diagram when I first started on the film. And it was a simple pyramid, and it was called the Pyramid of Importance. And oddly.
Where was Foley on this, by the way?
I'm going to send you some shoes after this.
Sorry, keep going.
Right. The focus, George, bringing it back in. I mean, in the middle of those
pyramid of importance. And at the top was, and the idea was simply this, in any given shot, and there are over 2,400 shots in Mad Max Fury Road, there is one sound we want to draw the ear to. And below it might be two subservient sounds that support it, and everything else can be dealt with or jettisoned. What we would do, practically speaking, when mixing Mad Max Fury Road was analyzing shot by shot, among other processes you do in a mix, and determining what do we want the audience to hear here. And so that would mean 2,500 iterations of that process. Know that George shot in a wide frame 5K image because all 2,400 shots in Mad Max Fury Road are repoed. For those that don't know what that means, every shot had where the camera was originally framed moved so that George could make sure you were looking where he wanted you to look. So too with sound did we determine that in any given shot, in every 2,400 shots of Mad Max Fury Road, we were only hearing what he wanted us to hear. And that would create a mix that had, in spite of, you know, the set piece at the end of the movie, which is a 10-minute chase sequence with bullets and guns and explosions, we would have sonic focus at every moment.
It's counterintuitive. I'll point out, it's counterintuitive. Action, big action scenes like that, it's counterintuitive that if you do what you're saying, it seems bigger.
Yes.
It won't seem bigger if you put 120 tracks in. It'll seem bigger if you focus it. So
what's I think really important about that for young sound editors is that we are tempted to cut too much stuff. And a great sound editor, a great sound designer delivers material that is already focused and it shows a point of view. And a point of view means just that, a point. There's one thing I want to make sure you hear.
100% agree. And that is really the job of the sound designer, is to focus the audience's attention. It's just like magic. So, you know, there's diversionary focus. There's focus that's designed to make people laugh. There's focus on music. And there's focus on dialogue. And when all of that is in balance, it creates this beautiful symphony of orchestrated audio.
I'd like to pick up now on something you said about the less is often more. And again, not to keep bringing up the great Walter Murch, but he once said, I don't know what I would do with more than 100 tracks, Tom. So,
can we go through our favorite Walter Murch quotes?
Yeah. Absolutely.
All right, Gary, you start. He's local to you.
I once walked by him in a hallway up at Skywalker once, and he just said, "Do you know the story of the origin of the ampersand?" I said no and ran. but the Walter quote, there's a Walter quote for everything. And what we're talking about, he came when I was in film school. I went to USC Film School, and he came to visit us. And it was during when Apocalypse came out. And he talked about the helicopter attack in Apocalypse. And he said, same what you're saying, he said, "I thought of the sound as a three-ring circus." Yeah. They don't make 7-ring circuses. They don't make 12-ring circuses. 3. So at any time, you're hearing, like Mark just said, you have 3 sounds that you're focusing on, maybe the priority one and 2 others, and then everything else kind of goes to the background if you can do it. And so I always think, 3-ring circus, yeah. Anyone else? What's your other Walter favorite?
My favorite is he says that if you want to understand water, study ice and steam, because those extremes will reveal more about water than water ever could.
I think I'll be waking up at 4 in the morning to take it. I got it. Mark, while you're thinking,
I don't really know Walter.
So. Okay, that's cool.
I can do an impression of him.
But the point being is limitations. There's an exercise. I've talked at schools where they only give a kid 60 tracks for a music project. That's all you get. And that limitation not just sort of forces you to focus, but it also, you're cleaning up something, right? I mean, to make a battle, when you say, "I just keep adding on," you're going to have mud. So what do you, talk to me about terms of limitations or simplicity and the role it plays in storytelling.
When I first started, I worked at Hanna-Barbera Studios. There was a cartoon studio that made the Flintstones and Scooby-Doo and things like that. And we were on sprocketed sound film. And we only had, I think as I remember, 6 channels for all audio, dialogue, music, and effects. And even though that meant I could at best hog 4 tracks for the sound effects, because it was linear media and analog media, I would prep a lot of sounds, but I could never, unlike in today's electronic media and workstations, I couldn't hear any of the, I couldn't hear them combined. And that limitation creates this kind of austerity that is a huge, a valuable exercise for everyone to subject themselves to, because it taught me to hear the mix in my head so that I would only deliver the 4 tracks of the sounds that I thought were the most valuable. Today we have, 2,072 channels available to us on 1 Pro Tools system, and it's a siren song to fill and fill and fill, and it can extinguish that kind of austerity we all need to practice to get to the point.
Well,
I remember a story where it must have been a CES Lifetime Achievement thing for Buzz Knudsen. And the story someone told was he was brought a whole long cue sheet to mix sound effects for some movie, and he just ripped it in half and said, we'll be mixing this. So go ahead, Walt.
Well, then I'll do my Walter Murch quote then, because he once said to me, "Tom, today, the sound designer thinks they have so many tracks available that if there's a junkyard alley fight, and there's garbage cans, and there's a mean cur dog, they will bring 4 versions of the bell of the dog to the mix." And he goes, "I would gladly sacrifice the dog collar in order to go for the jugular." And that struck me as a limitation in a way. I mean, make decisions, correct? Your version of the story. Gary? what, 22 tracks on Saving Private Ryan? Joke. What about limitations? Wiley, anything to say on limitations before we move on to your final thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think the why is really where you start to define limitations. And, you know, why are we doing this? And there can't be, like you say, more than a three-ring circus. Yeah. Or however you want to define why. It should be what's the most important singular novel idea, and then present that.
I have one more.
Please, go ahead.
From a practical standpoint, a good exercise for you as a sound designer is to do what I do, which is palette building. To build a palette, think of yourself as a painter. Most painters will have a notion for what they want the final image to look like, and they will construct a literal palette of, I want burnt ochre, and I want sky blue, and I want duck yellow. And that is an enforced restriction. Oddly, those enforced restrictions become extraordinarily liberating when you come to achieving the final result, because you've determined an overall aesthetic ahead of time. So too in sound, I will create a palette for myself that follows some kinds of rules. So for example, on Dune, the palette was to be built around a simple idea that the sound should sound like we dropped a documentary film crew on Arrakis and all they had was a boom pole. Anything that didn't fit that paradigm did not belong in our movie. Similarly, they can be much more simple. For example, I did two of the Flintstones live action movies, and the palette was simply to be no metal. It's the Stone Age.
Mark won't remember this, but I did a story on the Flintstones, and my hand claps were added, and they are now in the movie at the dub stage. Said, let's jump up on a microphone. We need to fill out the hand claps. And there were six people on the dub stage, and we got up on a mic, and they got into the movie. Gary, limits. I mean, anything that you want
to add? Here's another quote. Orson Welles said, the absence of limits is the enemy of art. So I think, and then I always think about, I think what Mark said about presenting your opinion about something. A lot of the mistakes we make sometimes in sound is you sort of get to the final stage and you still have all these options available. It's nice to choose as you go. So you're sort of limiting as you go in this funnel approach.
But palette building, Wiley, I mean, let's sort of expand on that just a bit. I mean, do you do that in a film? Do you go and gather your world? Is that how? That's a how, but I mean, why you would do that?
Yeah, I think palette building is essential, and it requires, you know, a different approach to every project. And so it's hard to say there's a formula for it, but what I would say is that it's an essential part of the thought process, and the palette is really the contribution that comes from the entire team, whether it's the composer, whether it's the production mixer, whether it's the film editor's vision of what the soundtrack should be like. So it's a community of people that build a palette of ideas, and those ideas in terms of sound then have to be interpreted by the sound DP.
And Gary, I think in terms of palette building, I remember on Jurassic Park, we ran a picture of Chris Boys, your assistant at the time. I was recording
the great Chris Boys, yeah.
Recording at the wildlife park, wildlife sanctuary, recording lions and tigers and bears.
Right, and then as I say, it was important to have your assistant do the dangerous recording. anyway, I took like, you know, sweet little birds and things like that.
But my point being, in your palette building, you're thinking, already thinking a T-Rex is going to have a lot.
Well, when you record,
I need animal.
Well, you need animal, but I think with recording part, which, you know, Chris and others, they're did for me for years, which is kind of an exploration. And you know, sometimes when you record sound effects, you don't know what you're going to get. So you have to be open to anything. So the palette, actually starting to organize it into a palette, which I completely do the same thing. That's once you get back to the studio and you start to organize your library and you say, well, that sounds right for this, that sounds right for that. But the collecting, which is really fun, is exploring and being open to anything, and and it also gets us out of the studio and we get some exercise.
I did it in our talks. All three of these gentlemen expressed they're inspiring. I mean, they inspired me. And when we started, we go over, like, what do we want to talk about? They all three said, it would be inspirational to the audience. I mean, some of their sheer joy of working in this world. So I'd like to ask their final thoughts. I mean, you speak at schools. I mean, should we go on down the line? Wiley, I mean, let's think of, what do you want to leave this audience with in terms of the shoe? I look at you and find joy at working in sound.
Yeah, I think it is a joyful work, pursuit. I'm going to steal a quote from Steve Jobs, and he basically said that artists have to deliver. And that's really an important thing. We start and we finish every project that we do. And as artists, we have to deliver. But I think the other thing that he said was about curiosity. And I think that curiosity alone is not really the answer. And it's really the miracle of compounded interest. And I know that sounds like a financial term, something that you've heard from your parents or some broker, but really compounded interest in terms of taking curiosity and converting it into knowledge is really everything. So it's great to be curious. It's really essential to convert that curiosity and compound that curiosity into knowledge about acoustical space, about plugins, about the whole world of sound. So I would just say to this wonderful community of artists and artisans, stay curious, but compound that curiosity into an ever-growing body of knowledge.
I think it's valuable for us to round out our knowledge with an education in things that have nothing to do with sound and technology. Two of the most valuable things I've done in my life were taking improv comedy classes and taking screenwriting classes and acting classes. Those have given me a set of communication skills that I didn't heretofore have. And I know you don't get these in film school if you're studying in sound. The reason why all of this is so valuable is that until we can learn to communicate with our collaborators, specifically the director and producer, until we can talk their language, speak at their level, because remember, their concerns are not kilohertz and speaker dispersion patterns. Their concerns are, is my story working? This, what does the protagonist want to achieve, and how do we get that character there? When you can start understanding those meta levels of story, you can then begin to apply sonic techniques that help the director further those goals. And the way to do that, plugins are great, but you're going to develop lifelong partnerships with filmmakers when they feel you are as much a partner and as invested in their story as they are. And you learn that by studying things that have nothing to do with sound.
100%.
Very nice, Gary. The closing comment.
Well, I think the collaboration is one of the things that drew me to this. I think it's an amazing part of filmmaking. It's what I like working with people because that's the only way I can kind of really come up with ideas. So what I've learned is if you hold on to people, hold on to experiences, movies, good movies, hold on to people that you work with, that you learn something from, you want to work with again, director, assistants, editors, crews, composers. I mean, those relationships become really important. And it's funny, I had dinner last night with Andy Nelson, who I've mixed a lot with, and we both are here today. And we talked about, okay, what do we love about sound? And so what we love is, for one thing, I love that sound is responsible for every frame of the movie. There's parts of filmmaking that I feel terrible for people who only do a part of the movie. So we do the whole thing. And the other amazing thing is, Andy and I talked about, we're in a room with a director on a film, and we have them to ourselves, and we kind of doing the collaboration with the filmmaker themselves, the person whose idea this was, and we're there for the birth of the film. Yeah. In a room like this, when the movie finally, when we do our part, and you kind of put the music in, and now it's, that's it. And these amazing films, and you're the first people to see it. The first people, and you see it with the director, you go, oh, and it kind of comes alive. And I think all art, there's technology is important. It's going to change, and there's going to be changes, and it's going to be hopefully for the better. But it's magic. Orson Welles said that too. I mean, filmmaking is magic. So when it works, it's hard to even explain why it works. But those moments where you sit and you're working on a scene or a reel or a movie, and you go, my God, this works. There's nothing, no better feeling than that.
And I do say, one of the reasons to bring it full circle, they're up here, is that joy, that magic, that sense of wow, is still with these three guys. I've been doing it 32 years, and I fell into an industry I absolutely love. I love the creativity. I love being around the people that do it. So let's give them a round of applause.